Bringing rain into tomorrow.
Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants. Since 1985, offering discerning patients and dentists options for same-day replacement of missing and compromised teeth. Information online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. On Monday, FIFA, soccer's international governing body, announced that the 2003 Women's World Cup tournament, removed from China because of the SARS epidemic, had been awarded to the United States. Sweden and Australia had also submitted bids for the cup, but FIFA felt the U.S., where the 99 World Cup exceeded all expectations, would be the place where organizers could most effectively pull together a world tournament in just a few months. Almost immediately, rumors began to fly. FIFA doesn't like fields lined for football, so some of the venues from the 99 Cup won't do. Never mind football lines. FIFA will put games in Gillette Stadium in Foxborough, Massachusetts, where both U.S. national teams have thrived before large crowds, and the final will be in the Rose Bowl just as it was in 99. The rumors emphasized the challenges that faced the organizers, who'd had years to prepare for the event in 99. Tom Meredith, the vice president of operations for the Women's United Soccer Association, is a veteran of tournament planning, and he will certainly be involved in organizing World Cup 2003, but he's not quite ready to clarify things yet.
The more people you have involved in a situation, the tougher it is. And with this kind of an international situation with the different countries coming, there's so many different cultural, practical, organizational issues that it just boggles the mind. I mean, where's George Allen when you need him?
Tom Meredith's reference to the late coach of the Washington Redskins and Los Angeles Rams is ironic on several counts. The 99 Cup was staged during the summer. Pro and college football will be underway when this World Cup occurs in September and October. That creates potential venue crunches. Another concern, at least on the part of WUSA Commissioner Tony DiCicco, is that FIFA and the folks at the U.S. Soccer Federation will pay insufficient attention to how much the Women's Pro League has already done to mobilize and entertain fans of women's soccer in the U.S.
I have big concerns here. The venues that are finally selected may exclude many of the WUSA markets, which I think is a loss in their resources because they work those markets 12 months a year. They know the contacts, and it's a loss to how well we can promote women's professional soccer in the WUSA and indeed soccer in this country.
Tony DiCicco's concerns notwithstanding, the official word out of the U.S. Soccer Federation, according to spokesperson Jim Morehouse, is that the Federation plans to take advantage of what the Women's Pro League has accomplished, as well as the triumphant performance of the U.S. national team in Palo Alto 4 summers ago.
We don't want to be comparing it to 99, but we do want to build off the success of 99. There's obviously going to be a lot of conflicts with football and baseball and other sporting events going on as opposed to July of 99. But we think the American public knows what it means to compete in a World Cup, and we don't need to tell people who Mia Hamm is or who Brandi Chastain is. Those are players that the American public knows well, and I think they'll come out and support it, as will the media.
Jim Morehouse is not alone in suggesting caution.
I just hope no one comes with expectations, but it's going to be like 99, because it's not going to be like that.
Kate Sobrero of the Boston Breakers has been a defender on the U.S. team since before the 99 World Cup.
They're only going to play in like 6 venues. They only have 4 months to put on this event. Last time they had a year. So just the publicity and the marketing and all that, it's just not going to be there. It'll be a smaller scale, but the meaning's just the same. And I think just the meaning of that will make up for the fact that there isn't the marketing dollars they used to have for it. Because everyone's just going to be excited no matter what, because it is a World Cup.
Concerns about where the games will be played and how many fans will show up on relatively short notice should not be allowed to detract from the fact that it's a soccer tournament we're talking about here. And a soccer tournament that, according to Canadian team goalkeeper Karina LeBlanc, is likely to reflect the changes in the landscape of the women's game since the 99 Cup. Now, says LeBlanc, people shouldn't be thinking just about the big three, the U.S., China, and Norway, but about at least a big half dozen. Not surprisingly, she thinks Canada can win.
Yeah, that's the plan. I mean, like I said, that's exactly where you see that the sport is risen, because you have so many other countries who are just waiting and knocking at the door, and whoever plays the best game will win that day.
The U.S. Soccer Federation and FIFA are expected to announce more particulars about World Cup 2003, including the specific venues and game dates, in 2 weeks. The 2003 NBA Finals begin on Wednesday in San Antonio. Joining me now on the line is Scott Howard Cooper, who covers pro basketball for the Sacramento Bee. He's also our regular NBA analyst here at Only a Game. Scott, welcome back.
Good to be with you again.
How strange will it seem to watch an NBA Final in which the LA Lakers are not involved?
Well, I think it's going to be a different thing for people to see, but at the same time, something that people did see coming, because the Spurs had the best record in the league during the regular season, so it's not like the biggest shock that they would end up there. But you're right, it does bring a different dimension to it, just because without Shaquille O'Neal there, it gives everybody else a much more realistic chance. He's the one guy in the league that really nobody has a straight-up matchup for.
And yet, somehow, the Spurs did eliminate the Lakers, and then they've had problems holding on to leads. Actually, have had that problem throughout the playoffs. Do we see that continue in the finals?
Well, I think so, because until they prove otherwise, and they'd better prove otherwise, they're going to be in trouble. New Jersey is from the East, a conference that gets knocked all the time as being little brother or the junior varsity or the wannabes or something like that. But the Nets are capable of winning this thing. I don't think it would be a major surprise for New Jersey to win.
The Spurs are there in large measure because of the incredible play of Tim Duncan. Can the Nets defense him? You previously said only Shaquille is somebody nobody matches up well with.
Well, they can defend him in the sense that Kenyon Martin, New Jersey's power forward, has been outstanding in these playoffs, and that's a huge key for them. Will Tim Duncan get shut down? No, absolutely not. Maybe you'll get him to have a bad half, or he can certainly have an off night just like everybody else. But the thing with the Spurs is, if you take Duncan and drop him down to 20 or 22 points a game, turn him into semi-mortal, that's going to force somebody else to step up on San Antonio. And one of the things they've had problems with this season is finding a consistent secondary scorer, that complementary weapon that will be there all the time. So if Martin continues to play as he has and, get some help from his teammates on defense, that gives New Jersey a much better chance.
The Nets come into the finals with a 10-game winning streak in the playoffs. They've got to be wondering, what do we have to do to not be the underdog?
Well, I think they probably have to win the championship. That's, as we were saying a minute ago, that's the problem with playing in the Eastern Conference. Everybody's sort of harassed it now going on a few years. And the Nets know that the last time they were in this situation, they got swept by the Lakers. Mm-hmm. So, they're not getting a lot of respect. I think they deserve to get more than they have. But to answer the ultimate question, what do they have to do? And that is, they have to win 4 of the next 7 games, and then they will have it. Then they will have earned it, which is the best way to get it, not to have people give it to you.
One consequence of winning all those games in a row, of course, is the Nets have been waiting for 2 weeks to see who they were going to play in the final. Does the layoff hurt them?
Well, I think that's certainly a problem, because I think San Antonio has the perfect situation. They get a few days off the final start on Wednesday, but not so long that you potentially lose the rhythm. I think the way it is good for the Nets is their best player, Jason Kidd, gets a little bit more time to rest his sprained ankle, and so he should be back in much better shape than if he only had 4 or 5 days. That sort of turnaround like the Spurs do. I think that's one of the real unanswered questions, though. I agree with you that potentially it could be a detriment to the Nets if they don't come out playing with the same rhythm.
You mentioned Jason Kidd. He is certainly the man most responsible for turning the Nets into contenders over the past 2 years. He could be leaving as a free agent this summer to join, of all teams, the San Antonio Spurs. Or does that happen as people had predicted it might?
Well, it's a possibility. I think it's less of a possibility than people have speculated. Jason has been doing his best to be informatively vague on this topic. He has sort of answered at one point by saying he hopes things work out and he wants to stay in New Jersey. Now, that's a very encouraging sign for Nets fans, both of them. The fact fact that their best player would stay and things will head off in a positive direction as they have now for the last couple of years. And then he turns back around and saying, well, sure, you know, I'm from Oakland and every kid dreams of growing up and playing for his hometown team. So I think, you know, Northern California is a situation I would have to look at. So as much as he sort of puts an end to it and says, I don't know why everybody is bringing this up, I want to play with the Nets, he sort of keeps it going. I think that's going to be the interesting thing in the first couple days of the finals. He's obviously, if he goes the first 22 seconds of the first interview session without getting the question about playing for the Spurs next season, that'll be the bigger upset than anything you've seen in all these playoffs.
Now, this may be the last time that you and I have an opportunity to speak this season, so I have to put you on the spot. Will it be the Nets or the Spurs lassoing the coveted Larry O'Brien trophy?
Well, I don't know if I'm just searching to be different, but I got a real feeling that the Nets are in a good place here. I'm going to go for the upset. I think partly, you know, it's what we've talked about, that the Spurs have had trouble finishing games, that if Kenyon Martin has been playing so well and if he can carry that over and do a good job on Tim Duncan, and again, not shut Tim down, but just sort of contain him, I give the Nets a really good shot.
We got to check and make sure they're not going to take away your West Coast boosters card for that.
Born and raised in California, and I gave it all away in one shot right there.
Scott Howard Cooper covers the NBA for the Sacramento Bee. Scott, thank you very much. We'll see you next year.
Take care. Thank you very much.
Sing once again of my love, my own broken dreams, empty words I know still live in my heart all alone. And that moonlit path by the Alamo, and Rosemary, Rose of San Antonio.
It's 18 minutes past the hour. For centuries, each spring, the residents of Gloucestershire, England, have celebrated the great and glorious tradition of the cheeses manufactured there by rolling large wheels of the scrumptious stuff down steep hills and then chasing after them. Those who capture the cheese wheels get to eat them. The jolly chase has sometimes led to injuries in an event that has been characterized as, quote, less like running down a hill than jumping off a cliff. Broken ankles and arms have not been uncommon. Monday was supposed to mark this spring's edition of Clamoring After the Cheese, but the chase has been quashed because the search and rescue unit that had planned to be on hand for the carnage is otherwise engaged.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the Post Club. Events and introductions for busy, discerning singles featuring an online private member website and personal counselors. Information at postclub.com. By Lavender Home and Table, French Country Living in the heart of Marblehead. Rustic antiques, artisan pottery collections, linens, and products for the bath and home. LavenderHomeAndTable.com. And the Capital Steps, performing their newest political musical satire at the Copley Theater, June 17th through the 22nd. Tickets on sale now through Ticketmaster and BossTix. Coming up on Monday on Morning Edition, a special series on kids in Massachusetts. The series, Children in the Margins, looks at education, health care, and other issues that affect children in the Commonwealth. That's Children in the Margins, a special series starting Monday on Morning Edition. 61 degrees in Boston. It's 7:20.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, a conversation with Roger Angel. But first, Annika Sorenstam shot a 10-under-par 62 in the first round of the LPGA's Kellogg-Keebler Classic yesterday. She and Rosie Jones are tied for the lead. The Sorenstam effect on the LPGA Tour is apparent, at least in the very short run. On Tuesday, press credential requests for this week's LPGA Tour stop were twice as numerous as normal, and advance ticket sales were up 50%. Large galleries followed Annika Sorenstam Thursday when she practiced and yesterday in round one, But will her appearance on the PGA Tour benefit the women's game over time? Joining me by phone from Daytona Beach is the commissioner of the LPGA, Ty Votaw. Mr. Votaw, welcome to Only a Game.
Bill, good to be with you.
There was some debate before and after the Colonial about whether Annika Sörenstam's appearance on the PGA Tour would be good for the LPGA. Do the numbers at this weekend's tournament mean that those who said Sörenstam was helping the cause were certainly right?
Well, I don't think there's any question about it. It was one of the reasons we supported her decision to play in the Colonial from the start. We felt new fans have been created for the LPGA as a result of her performance and playing in the Colonial last week. We think that that's going to continue certainly in the short term. And the long-term effects, I think, are going to be certainly a lot of things depend upon that. Her performance on the LPGA Tour generally, the fan interest that's been generated for women's golf as a result of her playing, maybe will make more women take up the game of golf, more young girls being excited about playing the game, and all of those are good things for the LPGA.
You spoke about the positive effects of Annika Sörenstam's appearance on the PGA Tour. Was it discouraging at all that the LPGA hadn't gotten more attention before that appearance?
The answer on some levels has to be yes. My statement to a lot of people who interviewed me leading up to Colonial was, I found it interesting that the debate in her playing Colonial was about how well she wouldn't do in the Colonial as far as the media's coverage of her decision to play. My question always has been, how well does she have to do on the LPGA Tour to garner the same amount of coverage just thinking about her ultimately playing in a PGA Tour event has generated? I mean, she won 13 out of 25 events she played last year, 11 on the LPGA Tour. I don't know how much better she has to be to get the media coverage she deserves. Does she have to win all of the events? Does she have to win 95% of the events? Does she have to win 70% of the events? I don't know. I think it speaks more to the coverage of women's sports generally and the editorial decisions that get made in our nation's newspapers, our nation's talk radio, sports programs, Sports Center, Fox Sports news coverage, et cetera, than it does anything about a lack of interest in terms of women's sports.
Given the pressure that Annika Sörenstam faced playing in that PGA tournament, are you surprised that she played as well as she did yesterday?
Nothing Annika Sörenstam does anymore surprises me, simply because she has had a remarkably consistent career on the LPGA Tour, and she's one of the most focused and mentally strong people that I've ever come across in any walk of life. And while there arguably could have been a letdown from last week, the fact that she played so well yesterday speaks volumes to that mental toughness and to her dedication and love and passion for the sport.
It seems to me that an increased number of fans and writers asking for press credentials is not ultimately as important a measure as an increased number of tournament sponsors would be, given measuring her impact on the LPGA. Is there any sense of whether that will happen, whether you get more sponsors banging at your door now?
Again, I think that's going to be something that plays itself over time. We haven't been able to secure a half a dozen sponsors in the past 4 days for future LPGA tournament schedules. But the LPGA has generated an enormous amount of growth and popularity in a number of key indices of success over the past couple of years. Our attendance last year was up 12% from the year prior. Our television viewership was up across the board on both national and cable telecast by over 20%. Our website traffic last year was up double digits every month. Half of our tournament sponsors raised their purses from last year to this year. Mm-hmm. And so the foundation that's been established with the quality and depth and breadth of our overall tour provides us with, I think, a great base to grow from. And certainly Annika's greater name recognition and greater generation of fan interest will ultimately result in more economic opportunities for all of the membership of the LPGA going forward. I think there's no question that that potential is exponentially enhanced than that potential existed last week.
Susie Whaley, a teaching pro who won the necessary qualifying event, will play in the Greater Hartford Open in July. Do you anticipate that her presence in that PGA tournament will have any impact on the LPGA Tour?
Well, we were supportive of Susie's decision to play simply because we think her reasons for doing so were the same as Annika's reasons, that is to test herself, to stretch herself against that level of competition, and to probably send a signal to young girls taking up the game, that there really shouldn't be a mindset of boundaries or limitations in anything you can do athletically. And if they were for some other reason or other agenda, whether it's some sort of social statement or some sort of political statement or some other type of agenda, we would have been probably less supportive of that, because we don't know if that sends the same kinds of empowering signals as what her ultimate reasons are and what Annika's ultimate reasons were. And we continue to support Susie and wish her the best of luck, and hope that that she gets everything that Annika got out of her experience at Colonial.
Ty Votaw is the commissioner of the LPGA. Ty, thank you very much for speaking with me.
You're very welcome. It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Of his presence at a windy playoff game at Wrigley Field in 1984, Roger Angel wrote, "I kept tight hold on my rustling scorecard and stat sheets and felt at one with the weather and the world." What a fine thing for lovers of baseball and fans of superb writing about the game that Mr. Angel discovered his own oneness with the world of the game over 40 years ago and has been giving it perhaps better treatment than baseball deserves ever since. Some of the best of Roger Angel's baseball writing has been collected in a recent volume entitled Game Time, A Baseball Companion. Roger Angel joins me now from NPR's New York Bureau. Roger, welcome to Only a Game.
Good to be back with you, Bill.
When you first began writing about baseball for The New Yorker, did anybody at the magazine ask, what the heck are you going to do that for?
Well, I don't think so exactly, but the editor, William Shawn, was interested in everything, but he knew nothing about baseball.
Mm-hmm.
And he knew we hadn't done much sports, and he knew I liked baseball, so he suggested I go down to spring training. And early, I don't know if it was that piece, but early on in my writing for the magazine, he came into my office one day carrying some galleys of a piece I'd just written, and he pointed to something, and he said, what's this? And I said, oh, that's a double play. And he said, what's a double play? And I told him, and his cheeks grew pink with excitement, as they did when he ever learned some new fact.
In a spring training piece you wrote in 1984 entitled Easy Lessons, you say that baseball, quote, saves you with its complexity. That really learning the game can take a lifetime, even if you keep notes. Has it been a challenge to find players who regard the game that way?
Well, not really. I don't talk to players quite as much as I used to, because I'm getting older now, and it's, if they call you sir, you're in big trouble. But I think if you can persuade players that all you want to talk about is how the game is played, that they will finally give you some attention. Over the years, I've spent a lot of time asking people, what do you do? And talking to catchers, for instance, who do a lot. And once I got across that this was what I wanted, you can hardly shut people up, because we all like to talk about what we do. And there's a lot more in the game, as we keep discovering, than appears at first glance.
In one of my favorite passages in the current book, this comes in an essay entitled One for the Good Guys, you write about how circumstances in a ball game can suddenly change. The permutations are many and comic. Would you read that passage, please, for me on page 345?
Sure. All sports are eventful, but baseball, unlike the others, sometimes becomes situational as well, suddenly presenting as participants, the players and the fans together, with as many interconnections and possibilities and opportunities for interesting disaster as a Cheever Thanksgiving dinner. That's John Cheever.
Of course.
More and more relatives turn up and crowd in around the table, some of whom you didn't expect to see here at all. Somebody is pouring another round of drinks, and suddenly there doesn't appear to be enough silverware or stuffing to go around. Nerves and certainties are fraying. Cousins are eyeing each other apprehensively. Voices are raised in the kitchen. Something awful is about to happen. How hot it is in here. How fraught.
That's just magnificent. I'm sure that you've identified in that passage and elsewhere why it is that so much good writing has come from baseball. The invitation is there. The plot twists, as you've pointed out, are various. Even though if you're a fan of the Red Sox or the Cubs, of course, you know that Hamlet's going to die in the end.
Well, yeah, I think this baseball moves at a different pace, as we know, and it's one thing and then another thing, which really is, it's like prose moving along. It's like sentences, and more than one person has made the comparison of a baseball game with a book, where there are sometimes wonderful early chapters and then a huge disappointment later, or an unpromising book gets better in the end and then rivets you. You never can tell.
Several of the essays in Game Time concern especially intriguing individuals that you've come to know, Pete Rose, Bob Gibson, Ted Williams. Shortly after Ted died, everybody, of course, had a favorite Ted Williams story to tell. But I hadn't encountered the particular hitting theory that he revealed to you anywhere else.
Well, I don't know how I can say it on the air, but he did once sit down with me. We knew each other because we each had a son named John Henry, which is a good enough excuse for Ted Williams to become your pal. And we always talked about this and compared how hard John Henry was. But he sat down with me once and said that all the young players with the Red Sox organization that he was watching now as an elder coach, he'd come back to see them, and instead of batting a 300 or beginning to drive the ball, we're all batting around 240 all the time. And what he said was that they were all having sex all the time. No, he didn't put it that way.
I'm sure he didn't.
And then he began talking about his early days, and he said that he didn't have his first sexual encounter until the All-Star break of his second year in the major leagues. He said, I was thinking about hitting.
And I'm sure he didn't put it quite that way either.
No, that's right. But he told me I couldn't write that. But when he died, I thought of it right away.
Mm-hmm.
And I saved it. It didn't seem quite right for an obituary, but I finally got it out in print.
Well, I'm glad you did.
No one else had heard that story.
None
of the old Boston writers that knew that story.
In your piece following the 2002 World Series, you write that you were, quote, trying to decide which of these two lively clubs, the Giants and the Angels, deserved to win the World Series on history and mojo. Is the result of a game or a series the proof, or does the less deserving team sometimes win?
Oh, all the time. I mean, it remains to be seen whether, I mean, I don't want to put down the Angels or the Anaheim fans, but that was a team on a terrific, terrific hot streak. They were just sensational at the end of the year last year. And whether they really are a better team than the Giants, or the real test would be the Oakland Athletics when they put out, I think maybe they are, but they were a big surprise to us. But sometimes the team goes a long way and doesn't seem to deserve it. I remember when San Diego got into a World Series against the Tigers, and the Tigers murdered them, but my feeling then was that the Padres were still a fairly new team, and I felt that their fans hadn't suffered enough to make it into the World Series yet.
They just didn't deserve it.
You've got to do a lot of losing before you deserve to get into the series.
I'm wondering if you have had anything like an experience that I've had. I came into baseball, as many people do, rooting for a particular team. In my case, it was the New York Giants back before they went to San Francisco. But as the years have gone by, it seems to me that I've come to root not so much for teams as for individual players who I get to know a little bit, and I want them to do well. I root for them, especially the ones coming back from injuries or, you know, other sorts of problems. Do you still root for a specific team, or do you find that you align yourself with individuals as well?
I think it's more teams. I know exactly what you mean. Certainly players I get to know that I look every day in the box score for about 15 different players that I care about or I know or made recent acquaintance with. But I think it works both ways. I'm not a fan of the Red Sox or the Mets or the Yankees or any one particular team all the time. The truth of the matter is that if I watch any team for three or four games, if I'm doing a story about somebody, drop in and watch a team just play less than a week, I become a fan of that team because I know who they are and I can see what's going on with the team and then I'm interested in them for at least the rest of that season and maybe after that. It doesn't take long. I once wrote, and it's true, that if I stop in Central Park and if I watch a pickup game or a corporate game of some kind, after about two or three innings, I pick one of the teams that I'm for. I don't know why, but you can't do this in the abstract. You've got to belong. As Mike Barnicle said, you know, that baseball is not a life and death matter, but the Red Sox are.
Right.
Exactly right.
But this is such a marvelous capacity for you to be sustaining after writing about baseball for all this time.
Well, I don't think it's built into me. I think it's built into the game. If you follow baseball at all, I think that it invites this identification because you have so much time to look at the players out there. You can see them at rest or seemingly at rest when they're in the field. And the classic pitcher-batter confrontation really focuses your attention, and you begin to care almost without wanting to. I think it's an automatic process, and it's one of maybe the prime attraction of baseball.
So you really strike me as one of those people who cannot be put off, despite all of the self-destructive things that we've seen in baseball from the owners especially, but from the players as well over the years.
Well, I hope that's right. They're testing me, but I don't mean the players so much or the owners, but baseball has changed so much. I mean, the experience of going to a ball game is nothing like what it was 25 or 30 years ago. I mean, it's noisy. There's a constant stuff going on from the gigantic scoreboard and television going on all the time. But at its center, the game is just the same. And you can look out at a shortstop and you can compare him in your mind with all the other shortstops that are playing, but also with the shortstops down the years that you have seen.
Mm-hmm.
And that, again, I think is a particular capacity that this game has.
And it's still great fun.
Yeah, sure, sure. It's going to be fun. I don't go out of duty, not very often.
Roger Angel has been writing about baseball for The New Yorker for over 40 years. Game Time, a collection of his work, has just been published by Harcourt. Roger, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thanks, Bill. Thank you very much. Good to be with you.
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing to us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website at www.onlyagame.org. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston, where Only a Game is produced, and from the other NPR member stations airing this program. Additional support comes from Thermo Electron, the scientific instruments company with a mission to advance drug discovery, improve manufacturing, and protect people and the environment, on the web at thermo.com. And from Nutter McLennan and Fish, working to solve critical legal issues on local, national, and international levels. Information at nutter.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Adesso, adjoining the Four Seasons Hotel, featuring the Ligne Rosé Furniture Collection, open 7 days a week and online at their redesigned site, adessoboston.com. Caritas St. Elizabeth's Medical Center, an academic affiliate of Tufts Medical School and member of Caritas Christi Healthcare. Information on their physicians and programs is available at semc.org. And by Crescent Ridge Dairy, the dairy that delivers, offering home delivery of farm fresh milk in glass bottles. Now available at Bread and Circus Whole Foods Market and on the web at crescentridge.com. Good morning. I'm Dolores Handy. And sports headlines. The Boston Red Sox lost to the Toronto Blue Jays 13-2 last night. The two teams play again today at the Sky Dome. Casey Fossum will be on the mound for Boston. The Red Sox have recalled infielder Freddie Sanchez from AAA Pawtucket to replace Shea Hillenbrand on the roster. Hillenbrand was traded to Arizona on Thursday. The New England Revolution at home this afternoon, hosting Kansas City at Gillette Stadium. Your online pledge for the news right now will enter you in a drawing to see a New England Revolution game with the producers of Only a Game and five of your friends. Enter the drawing today at WBUR.org. Mostly cloudy today, highs near 70, rain moves in late afternoon.
NPR's Sylvia Poggioli.
Kosovo Albanians, the overwhelming majority of the population, are impatiently demanding independence. The dwindling number of Serbs, strongly supported by Belgrade, insist Kosovo must remain part of Serbia.
Meet Sylvia Poggioli and ask her your questions about the Balkans and other major stories she's covered tomorrow at a brunch hosted by Tom Ashbrook. For tickets to benefit WBUR, call 800-909-9287.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, a return to a Wild West, which is more weird than wild and not really west of anything much. But first, a look at the sports news with our analyst, Charlie Pierce. Hello, Charlie.
I'd be lying if I said I understood that.
Oh, you'll just have to keep listening.
We know you're disappointed that Shaq is home for the NBA playoffs. Are you consoled that when the finals begin on Wednesday, the teams led by Tim Duncan and Jason Kidd will be there?
I'm consoled that these two teams are playing because I think it'll be by far the most interesting series. People will run and jump and shoot and score, and we'll see very few, I hope, very few of these 90-79 or 90-78 deals like we saw the other night when San Antonio put the clamps on Dallas.
The New Jersey Devils took full advantage of home ice advantage in the Stanley Cup Finals. The Devils are up now 2-0 over the formerly mighty and amazing Ducks. Is Anaheim's goose cooked?
Yeah, I'm afraid it is. New Jersey, when it gets into this position, does what it does better than any other hockey team in the NHL. It does provide for terrible television and even worse ice hockey. But the New Jersey Devils, more than any other team, managed to inflict what they want to do on the opposition. They're going to do it to the Ducks. They're going to win an increasingly dreary Stanley Cup.
Still, there's perhaps some spice in this matchup, since it does pit brother against brother, literally.
Yeah, I mean, we have the battle of the Niedermeyer family, which does nothing more than spring leaping to my frontal lobes the phrase, "Niedermeyer, dead!" But I have a feeling that the Niedermeyer family home movies are probably more interesting than the Stanley Cup Finals.
Although not more interesting than Animal House, perhaps. Elsewhere in the National Hockey League, the goalie of the score, as opposed to the goalie of the decade or the goalie of the century, has retired.
Yeah, Patrick Roy has always been one of my favorite hockey players. I always thought that, like, the day he retired would be the day the goalpost started talking back to him. It's time to quit, Patrick. It's time to quit. We're not going to help you anymore.
May have happened.
Get off the ice. I mean, he became a star in Montreal when it was a great place to be a star. And then he moved to Colorado and helped create a great place to be a star. He, without question, at least in my mind, is the greatest big game goalie since Ken Dryden.
Charlie, after Cincinnati pitcher Jeff Austin gave up home runs to the first three Atlanta batters that he faced on Tuesday night, he was sent down to AAA. No surprise there. There was a surprise, however, in his reply. Austin said, quote, "My goodness, this team is definitely better off without me. I'm surprised I've stayed here this long." Is he your new hero
as
well?
That's a wonderful quote, and I wish I could say it wasn't going to come back to haunt him. But you know, in some dossier in the Cincinnati personnel office, there's a red note saying, doesn't have it to play in the major leagues
right,
or something.
Right,
and some humorless scouting drone will mark this up against him, and I hope he gets traded to some team and beats Cincinnati about 9 times after it happens.
At a Class A South Atlantic League game in Lakewood, New Jersey last Friday night, an umpire ejected a groundskeeper. What do we do with these power-mad men in black?
He apparently was pointing out to the umpires that it might be too wet to play, and the umpires were ignoring him. He says he was yelling out to the umps and signaling. Now, you can drive a truck through that word signaling, okay? Exactly how were you signaling and what were you suggesting they do about it?
On May the 7th, David Horton and his girlfriend attended a Cincinnati Reds home game at Great American Ballpark, and they were caught on the scoreboard kiss cam, which is a gimmick they have out there, prompting Horton's parole officer to recognize and then help arrest the wanted man. Has Damon Runyon been spotted anywhere around Cincinnati recently?
I have absolutely no idea about this. David Horton is not one of your most successful criminals. He had gotten out after he had done 2 years of a 4-year sentence starting in 1999. He got busted on March 27th, failed to appear in court, but did appear in the ballpark. And what can I say except, my goodness, I think the Reds are better off without him.
Charlie, you've called NASCAR this country's most forward-thinking sports entity. NASCAR now finds itself in the middle of a dust-up between Jesse Jackson and one of his harshest critics. Does NASCAR still have your endorsement?
Of course it does. Jesse Jackson is being picked at by one of these fly-by-night mailing list right-wing strip mall things out of North Carolina, which, you know, has been after him for years. NASCAR is making a legitimate effort toward diversity. The interesting thing is NASCAR President Mike Helton said NASCAR does not endorse political views. Well, Mike Helton might consult the history of his organization. NASCAR was founded by Bill France Sr., who happened to be the sugar daddy behind both of George Wallace's runs for the presidency, largely because the governor gave Bill France the land for practically nothing to build the Talladega Superspeedway. So NASCAR has endorsed political views. It's just now endorsing slightly more liberal-minded and forward-thinking and less retrograde ones.
Finally, Charlie, Michigan high school student Joe Kavanaugh acquired 800 pairs of glasses with fuzzy eyebrows and mustaches attached, and last week he convinced 800 students and faculty to put them on, thereby shattering by nearly 300 the record for most people in one place at one time wearing Groucho Marx glasses. Do you suppose he'll tell his children about this one day?
All right, I'll be the grump and ask, how is this sports?
The saddest thing
about it is there was a record to break.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine and joins me each week here on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
It's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard.
I'll stay a week or two. I'll stay in the summer through. But I am telling you, I must be away.
In the wild, wild east, where domesticated cats roam and tumbleweeds tumble only on television, modern-day cowboys and cowgirls have found a home on the range. The shooting range, that is. Cowboy action shooting is the fastest-growing shooting sport in the country, and it boasts 50,000 members worldwide. Only a Game's Karen Given traveled to the Rhode Island frontier for our story.
Anchor horse. Picker.
Oh, going up the one now.
At first glance, the Manville Sportsman's Club in Manville, Rhode Island, looks like a typical shooting range. But if you drive past the guys in flannel shirts shooting clay pigeons near the clubhouse and the pickup truck in the parking lot with the bumper sticker that says, "I love animals 'cause they taste so good," what you'll find is something and someone a little different.
My name's One Ear Pete, and I'm called that because I just have one ear, got took off by a grizzly bear back in 87. You know?
No, you're not talking about 1987, are you?
Oh, no, that's 1887. Yes, indeed.
One Ear actually has two very functional ears, and he's quite aware that the year is 2003. But that's not the point. He's one of 20 shooters to brave gray skies on this early Sunday morning to try his aim at the Lincoln County Lawman's monthly cowboy action shootout. Like the rest of his posse, One Ear's dressed in period costume, though he left his chaps at home because of the rain.
Okay, posse number one. I am Lucky. Angry Horse.
Sound off.
Grizzly Skinner.
Every week.
Durango Rio.
Ho.
Durango Hooligan.
With the hoe.
I.W. Killam.
This morning's shooting groups, or posses, include Hezekiah Ezekiel Hipshot, Smedley McGee, Miss Belle Avalon, I.W. Killam, and, of course, the unknown drifter.
All right, posse, round it up!
We knew you were coming.
The first stage is set to look like an Old West saloon, complete with cartoonish-looking plywood cutouts of a bartender and a nine-fingered gunslinger with his hands in the air. Range officer Happy Trails explains what this stage has in store.
It's just another Saturday night, and you're having a few at the bar with old Sam the bartender, when all of a sudden a passel of critters just seem to appear out of nowhere. They're either real, or Sam's been feeding you some of his special rot gut. Either way, you got to dispose of them. How to shoot it?
Happy Trails lets everyone know how many bullets to load into each revolver, rifle, or shotgun, and the order in which to hit the targets. As the shooting begins, it's apparent that this sport doesn't just look different, it sounds different, too.
Is the shooter ready?
The shooter is ready.
Stand by.
When hit with hand-loaded ammunition fired out of period or replica weapons, some of the tin targets ring out in a way that's almost musical.
Marshal, Roger!
Each stage is timed and scored for accuracy.
One miss!
One of the stage's fastest and most melodic times comes from Cayuse, a duly elected territorial governor of the Single Action Shooting Society. Like most of the gunslingers here, he conveniently ignores me when I ask for his real name. but he will tell me what he does when he's not shooting.
I'm a field engineer for a computer outfit. I am a Dell dude.
Cayuse has been shooting cowboy for 7 years, long enough to become known for wearing hats with the rim curled up in the front and lightning-quick times, a skill he developed competing in other, more traditional shooting sports.
Trap, skeet, pistol, you name it, I've done it, but this is the only one I do now.
How come?
You can't have much more fun than this. Right, boys?
So it's all about having fun?
Absolutely.
Do you care if you win?
He does.
I do.
Cayuse is accompanied by a more grizzled character with a bit of a mean look in his eye. I decide to brave it and ask for his name.
Abilene Bill, out of Kansas.
Out of Kansas. What do you do in Kansas?
Kill people.
Actually, Abilene Bill is an iron worker from Rhode Island. He likes to remain in character, but he'll drop it for a moment to explain why he loves this sport.
Crazy, I guess. Always been a cowboy, ever since I was a kid. I love it. Just look around you. They're all people having fun, good time. You know what? One thing about cowboy shooters, you can leave a wallet or your six gun right in your gun cart, walk away 3 hours later, come back, and it's still there. Nobody touches it. It's the cowboy way. You know why? Because they'll kill you if you touch it. Okay. I think we're ready to rock here.
As Abilene Bill takes to the range, I begin my search for a less frightening character. It doesn't take long to find one.
Hey, Num, how you doing?
Good.
This is Num from How Do You Do?
Hi.
Hi, I'm Karen.
Hi, Karen, I'm Tom. My real name is Tom.
Your real name is Tom. Very good.
But we don't use real names here.
Like most cowboy shooters, Num Thumb gets the joke.
I've been a competitive shooter for a long time, but when I got into this, I was always a Western fan. It took me a little time to get comfortable dressed up like this. You know, I felt a little awkward at first, but if you look around, it's like a movie set. It's just great.
Sure enough, on the next range, the stage is set as an Old West camp, complete with a plywood cutout of a mangy dog and a campfire with fake flames. Competitors begin in a rather compromised position.
How to shoot it. Start sitting in the outhouse with empty holsters. At the beep. Exit the outhouse and yell, "Oh, crap!
Oh, crap!"
Grab your shotgun and shoot the four shotgun targets.
Like on a movie set, cowboy shooters have lines. And though they might not get extra points for acting ability, that doesn't stop some from relishing this part of the game.
Holy crap!
Shotgun, shotgun, shotgun.
Thank you.
Check the gap. Good.
Shooters load their weapons under the watchful eye of a volunteer just before they take to the range. Immediately after shooting, another volunteer will check to confirm the guns are empty.
Good enough.
Cowboy action shooters are sticklers for safety. There are no quick draws or trick shots. Those would be dangerous. And even a casual observer gets a safety lesson. Mine comes from One Ear Pete.
Someone hands you a firearm. You always either have them show you that it's empty or you do it yourself. Now, this is a nice old gun. Again, action's opened, showing that it's empty and can't fire. Safety is primary. Fun is secondary, but we really work on the fun part. Yes, this is Yula Nissen. This is the little woman who came over from Norway and married me. She came over to bake some bread.
And I met old One Ear and I got married. I've learned English very well, haven't I?
Yula's one of just three women at today's shoot, though she assures me that out west there are more women and even kids shooting cowboy. Yula had never held a gun before a year ago and freely admits that she didn't plan to shoot.
Yeah, I'm with One Ear. You know, you marry somebody and that's their sport, you know. Often I think in the East here a lot of the wives are shooters because the men are shooters. Who wants to be alone all weekend? So I don't want to be a golf widow. I overcame a distaste of a fear, I guess. And I can do it. I'm all right. I'm usually at the bottom, but I'm all right.
But do you enjoy it while you're doing it?
Yeah, I do. I worry every night beforehand, you know. And, And it scares me to death, but here I am.
Okay, we want 9 rifles, right?
9 rifles.
So, 9 rifles we got. 2.
Eula struggles a bit to get her rifle loaded, and sure enough, she's near the bottom of the pack when the day's scores are tallied. But she insists that won't stop her from competing.
I don't care. I know. I'm out here with people I like and a hubby I love, so. When we immigrants come over and marry, we marry for life, let me tell you. Eula is faithful.
For Only a Game, I'm Karen Sparky Given in Manville, Rhode Island.
Okay. I think we're all set, Bill.
All set. Stand by.
Little bit lonesome, little bit blue, cleaning my rifle, dreaming of you. Beautiful memories come into view while cleaning my rifle and dreaming of you.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is Michael Garth. We had help this week from Manoli Weatherill at NPR in New York. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a tape of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15 postpaid. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear this program again, sign up for the Only a Game newsletter or marvel at Karen Given's shots taken of and not at cowboy action shooters. Please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word this week comes from One Ear Pete, who warns his fellow cowboy action shooters to mind their manners around Only a Game's Karen Given.
Don't give her a hard time and keep the cussing and spitting down to a minimum.
Gee, if old One Ear worked here in the Only a Game office, we'd not only be much nicer to Sparky, I mean Karen, but it'd be a much cleaner place as well. I'm Pecos Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. Keep your head down, and I'll see you next week.
That goodbye kiss you left on my lips is still just like new, and the dream you left in my heart will someday come true. But in the meanwhile, think of me, do, cleaning my rifle and dreaming of you.
Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, offering discerning patients a same-day tooth replacement solution for failed root canal treated or missing teeth. Information is available online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.